It's time for Fed Talk, the live show for Feds in the know. From federal agencies to Capitol Hill, the attorneys of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth bring in experts from across the federal community to bring you inside the issues. Fed Talk is meant to provide general information about legal issues. However, the views expressed in this program are not intended to provide legal counseling. Listeners are cautioned not to rely upon any statements made in resolving legal issues they may face, but instead to consult with their own attorney about specific situations. Attorneys are not engaged in providing legal services while appearing on the program and are not responsible in any manner for the consequences that may stem directly or indirectly from reliance on any statement made during this program.
Good morning and welcome to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth. I'll be hosting your show this morning along with my law partner, Julie Perkins, who's also joined me to host the show. Good morning, Julie.
Good morning, Debbie.
And with us today in the studio, we're very fortunate to get a guy like this today in the studio, is Stan Soloway, which is a name that, according to everything I've read about Stan, everybody should know that name. He's the 100 top this, he's the 100 top that.
But Stan, have a life.
Right, but Stan is the president and CEO of the Professional Services Council, PSC, which is the voice of the government services industry. And Stan's going to join us today for the next 55 minutes to talk about federal government contractor perspective on the issues facing the federal government workforce and the federal government today. And we scheduled Stan a few weeks ago to be on the show, and how apropos that you would be here during a shutdown where most people are talking about, Stan, the 800,000 federal civil servants who have been furloughed. There's the ripple effect out into the greater economy is enormous, and we're really delighted, Stan, to have you with us. So thank you for joining
us. My pleasure. Great to be here.
And as I said, Stan is the president and CEO of the Professional Services Council. He's been there since 2001. As far as I can tell, you represent almost 360 companies have joined and are members of your council. But why don't you tell us, Stan, a little bit about you and how, you know, because you've only been there since 2001. You had a life before that, didn't you? You had a career and a life before
Parts
that.
Parts of which I can't talk about. I did. I actually came to PSC from the Defense Department. I was in the Defense Department the second half of the Clinton administration doing acquisition policy and also running the Secretary's Defense Reform Office.
Yes.
And got recruited over to PSC as we were exited in 2001.
Right. You were the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense.
Mm-hmm.
For acquisition and reform, and even before that, before working in Clinton II, you had a career in public policy and acquisition, privatization, and which I assume is what got you into the Clinton administration.
Yeah, I had my whole career had been mostly in public affairs, and then in the late 80s, I got involved through some clients working on government management issues, acquisition issues, and so forth. And then, of course, with the National Performance Review, this kind of became center stage. I got much more involved. A professional basis, and 1997 got a phone call out of the blue, and that's all she wrote.
Right. The phone call out of the blue. It doesn't happen like that anymore, you know. Everybody's so overly vetted,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, they obviously didn't do a very good vetting job.
Right. Let's rewrite history here. So, Stan, tell us about PSC. Who are you? What do you do? And who are your members?
So we have actually closer to 370 members, but who's counting? We're the largest.
You are.
We do count. We represent companies of all sizes that do anything you can imagine in the services sector for the federal government. We have very, very high-end technology all the way down literally to operations and maintenance of all kinds, international development, social sciences, engineering, research and development. So companies that kind of do everything you can imagine. And essentially, we are the voice of that industry. We're the largest organization of its kind, and we have a lot of the household names and then a lot of smaller and mid-tier firms. About 60% of our companies are small or small mid-tier firms. What we do is really three things. One is obviously advocacy. Our role is to promote and advocate for smart business policies that enable the government to get highest quality and best value for what it needs, and also enables companies to operate efficiently and effectively mm-hmm. and successfully. We also are sort of what we can call a resource, both for the government and for our companies, in terms of thought leadership, analytics, basic market research, helping our companies understand what the trends are, what the market drivers are, navigate what is a really complicated and increasingly expensive environment. The costs of doing business with the government are clearly going up. Not always clear that there's any return on that investment for the government, but that's a whole separate issue. And so we do that, and we also serve as the primary meeting place, if you will, for the community, for the for both our membership to commune, and also as a great bridge to the government. We have a lot of government folks. We have a lot of collaborative efforts going on. We've done things like I participated as a member of an acquisition strategy panel for one agency because they wanted industry input on an acquisition strategy. We did an analysis at the request of the Secretary of Homeland Security of their small business programs. I mean, so there's a lot of different things that we will do to work with agencies and also with our companies.
Right. And of course, the work of government over the last few decades, so much of the work of government is contracted out into the private sector. And I always remind folks, because you go through these phases where there's the contractor bashing, and then you go through phases where privatize, the private sector can do it better than the government. And the reality is that the government does so much. The country's so big. You know, we've gone from, I forgot the population of the country doubled, and I forgot how many decades, but, you know, we're 300 million Americans who demand a lot of services from their government, even though some people think they don't demand them. They really do demand a lot of services from their government. And, you know, you think about the workforce that has to get it done and the number one military defense in the world. It takes more than 1.9 million people to make that happen. And it is a capitalistic economy. And there's no doubt that in many instances, the private sector can really do it better.
Well, you know, here's how I look at that. I think that we've spent way too much time in the last 15 or 20 years taking a all for one or all for the other position, this divisiveness. And it always made me uncomfortable when I heard people say the private sector is always better. Clearly, the public sector is always better. This battle is really nonsensical, and it really ignores the realities. Forget for a minute the scope of what people want. The reality is that unlike 50 years ago or 40 years ago, the government today does not play the same role it used to play. Like you said, it plays a role in delivering lots of services. But in terms of how those services are delivered, the government is not leading edge in terms of developing technology and so forth to do it. And the reality is there's no way to deliver those services without what we refer to as the whole of government. So when we talk about shrinking government, what do we mean? Because the government's defined by its budget and its mission, not by the number of direct employees it has. And unless we start thinking about the government as a whole of government, that's the public sector, the private sector, the nonprofit sector, universities, and so forth, then you can't really be strategic in how you want to allocate your resources and really get the job done.
Right. So, it's the concept of public policy. What's good, you know, what's the good of the public? And all of those interests, I don't want to say interest groups, but the factions in our society that have an interest in what's good for our society is very multifaceted. It isn't just a bureaucracy, a government bureaucracy. It isn't just state governments. You're right. It's organizations, nonprofit organizations. And you're right. There are things that the private sector is better at than the government's better at, government workers. But there are obviously things that government workers, it's their bailiwick. And this all or nothing kind of approach sort of just, you know, do you feel like the ping pong?
Yeah, I mean, it is. It gets a little crazy, and it's not healthy. And when we talk about the commission report later, I think we'll get into some of this because that's part of what we try to address in there. But I think the simple fact is that for those who've never been in government and have this negative view of government, you get in and you find out how many people are working their tails off every day right. in and day out. And those who've never been in the private sector in our community don't realize how seriously people take the mission there. It's not all about just the holy dollar. And yes, there are profit pressures and so forth. But the fact is a good market economy uses profit pressures as a lever for quality. And that's what the government still struggles to get right.
Yeah, no, my law partner, Jerry Shaw, who's retired, he taught me that. I can't tell you how many years ago. I don't know if you ever met Jerry. But, you know, he would always say, in terms of just our own law practice, he would say competition's good because it makes us develop a better service.
Exactly.
And I remember hearing that for the first time and thinking how enlightening. Because most people think you're going to be you have anxiety or fear of competition, but in a really strong capitalistic economy with strong companies, he would say it's just better for the consumer. They get a better quality, better quality goods and services.
And in this market, everybody understands, the companies understand, we all understand that there's going to be heavy oversight. It is the public dollars, the public trust. There's a different set of rules. But those can also go too far to sub-optimize for the taxpayer, for the agency, let alone put more pressures on the company. So it's one of the things we'll talk about with the commission report is it really is important to start thinking about government as a whole, not as pieces.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And before we do take our break, I want to mention that that your council, the Professional Services Council, you know, this isn't just a creation of our sort of current mindset in privatizing, you know, in the last decade or so, privatizing what government does. You've been in existence since 1972.
Yep. 42 years.
42 years.
42 years in the fall.
And when you think about what government was 42 years ago, you really don't think that it had a private sector element to it.
This was a nascent industry, but the way we look at it is if you look at how the economy has emerged over the last 25 years, all around technology, new business processes, and all those other pieces, that's how the professional services industry has grown in the real world and how it's grown in government.
Yeah, no, it's to me, to see the date that this council was created and to realize that somebody had the vision to sort of understand that there was a need for advocacy and cohesiveness and, you know, for representation of a very important part, a sector of how government works back in 1972 when people didn't even think about, you know, government contractors. I thought it was very visionary. Mm-hmm. And here we are today. We will be speaking about the Leadership Commission report that PSC issued just recently, but we need to take our first break. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Today, my journey to help save people money on car insurance brought me to our nation's capital. I was taking a stroll around the mall when I met a very nice gentleman from Ohio who asked me a question. What kind of word is GEICO anyway? An excellent question, I replied. I told him that GEICO isn't a word, it's an acronym, and it stands for Government Employees Insurance Company. I explained how GEICO actually got its start 75 years ago to help federal employees save money on car insurance. Interesting, the man replied. But today, GEICO saves lots of people money on car insurance, including me. Have you ever thought about changing the name? I said. It's a thought. But Gecko sounds like Geico. If we change the name, I might be out of a job. We strolled a bit more, stopped for some tea, and we both agreed. It's probably best to keep the name just like it is. Geico.
To get a free rate quote, go to geico.com, then buy online or over the phone. If you're a federal employee or belong to an association like Big, Few, Young Government Leaders, and others, you may qualify for a special discount. Contact Geico today to request your special federal savings.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth. I'm hosting the show this morning with my law partner, Julie Perkins. Today's show is highlighting the federal government's contractor community, represented by the Professional Services Council. We're delighted to have with us today Stan Soloway, who is the president and CEO of PSC. And I understand that we will be joined right now by one of the co-chairs of the PSC's Leadership Commission, Robin Lineberger. Robin, are you there?
I am. Good morning.
Good morning, Robin, and welcome to our show.
Thank you.
And Robin, you're a principal at Deloitte Consulting.
I am.
And yeah. As I understand, you are a member of the council, and you're also one of the co-chairs of the Leadership Commission.
That's correct.
Tell me how you got roped into being the co-chair.
Well, I think as we were convening as a board and an executive committee, we were looking at some of the artifacts, some of the challenges that we're seeing out in the marketplace as it relates to professional services. And rather than just sitting around the table grumbling, Ellen Glover mm-hmm. and I sort of stepped up and said, let's organize a group and see if we can't weigh in on this issue and provide some advice.
You volunteered?
Well, I guess I'm afraid to say I did.
That's what, you know, when you join and you become, you know, you join on a council or a board of directors or you become a member of a council or board of directors, you know, you only want people like you, Robin, who actually have it in their heart to actually serve as opposed to fill a space. But I actually had the opportunity to read the commission report, and it is dense. It's dense. It's got a lot in there.
It does. We spent from January through really the end of the spring researching and pulling our thoughts together, and then the summer sort of editing and beginning to socialize our thoughts to make sure that we weren't off the mark. And yeah, it's quite a piece of work.
Yeah, it really is. Is it online, Stan? Can people read
it?
It
is on our website at www.pscouncil.org.
Yeah.
Right on the homepage.
Yeah, I think it's, hopefully it's the beginning, Robin and Stan, of a conversation that people who care about good government have been trying to have. But Robin, can you tell us what the commission is and again, sort of the impetus for creating the commission?
Sure, sure. In terms of who it is and what it is,
mm-hmm.
the commission has about 19 of our PSC Council board members on it, and that really represents a subset of the hundreds of organizations that are subscribed to the PSC. And so the executive committee membership, all CXO-level individuals that have the same interest and passion at trying to address this issue. So it's really that group. It represents the voice of the entire Professional Services Council. And so it's a group of colleagues that wanted to weigh in on this issue.
Yeah, Debbie, if I could just add,
sure.
as we talk about that, and Robin and Ellen stepped up to do this, one of the discussions that we had, one of the prompting forces, one of the artifacts that Robin was referring to, is every other year we do a survey of federal acquisition leaders and practitioners. It's the government talking to us, not us talking to government. And this was the 10th year, the fifth survey we had done was 2012, and the results came back, and they were so depressing. The message very clearly from the results was things are not only not better, they're getting worse. We lack critical skills. This is the government folks talking to us, and this includes
this was surveying government.
Absolutely. It's government, young government professionals as well as senior leaders saying we don't have the right skills, our training isn't on target, we're worried about the demography, resources, all that kind of stuff. We couple that with lots of programs that struggle. What are the challenges? Why is innovation so limited? There are great. We were at the Service to America Medals dinner last night, and some extraordinary stories. But they unfortunately are not always the norm. And it takes unique leadership. So, as we were talking about the survey, and I distinctly remember Robin and others in this conversation, it was like, well, what do you do with this? And around that time, Robin, if I'm not mistaken, I think the partnership itself had some survey research or some reports around morale. And
yes.
faith and confidence in their own leadership and so forth. So it really became an opportunity to look at this from that whole of government perspective, not just as an industry view. So we talked to CIOs, CAOs, CHICOs. We had a lot of engagement with government folks as well as our own community.
Mm. And Robin, you did all this in just a handful of months.
Yeah, we did. Part of it was that kind of to Stan's point is there's a lot of background information out there now, and rather than going and replowing the same ground and coming up with the same finds, we said if we take the data that we're seeing as well as augment that with our own research, what can we do about it? So we really did spend our time collating what the messaging was, and then really weighing in on opining on what can we do to make a fundamental changes here.
And what did you identify? What were the sort of challenges that your commission identified? Because there's a series of recommendations that are all laid out. What were the challenges you identified first before you had recommendations?
Yeah, so I think Stan mentioned two of them, that the Acquisition Leadership Survey as well as the Partnership for Public Service reports.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing we looked at, of course, is we're sitting right in the middle of a fairly interesting time with respect to fiscal uncertainty,
yeah.
austerity,
mm-hmm.
Some of the data that's coming out around the human capital, age discrepancies, this camel humped sort of, early in their career, late in their career, but the gaps in the middle.
Mm-hmm. Which is what I was saying to Stan before we went on the show. You know, David Walker, former head of GAO, has been talking about this since the 90s, right, Stan? Is it that far back?
Yeah, he has, but I think the thing
is
that we discovered...
It feels like no one's listening.
Well, that's one of the frustrations I think we all shared, and one of the things to Robin's point, that one of the specifics that I think stunned us, and this was something we had discovered before the commission got together, we were doing some other research, is if you talk about demography in the federal workforce, mm-hmm. we all talk about the aging workforce, we talk about having four times as many people over 50 than under 30, and whether we're hiring enough people, yada, yada, yada. That's all really important, and it's worrisome, but there are two other key data points that people don't talk enough about. One is that in the technology workforce, the IT workforce, which one could argue is core to where the government's going, you have 10 times as many people over 50 as under 30. Only 5,000 people out of the 78,000 or whatever it is in the IT workforce, according to OPM, are under 30.
That statistic struck me when I read your report.
An astounding number. It is about as bad a demography as you see any workforce. Now, that's not saying we're not getting good people. Clearly, the pipeline is clogged and you can't get them. So that's part of this whole of government. The second thing is, we've been talking, I was once accused of being Chicken Little because I was talking about this, the retirement wave. Yeah, years ago we were accused of this. The retirement wave is starting. We've had a 30% increase in retirement rates each of the last 2 years. In March, OPM announced four times as many retirements were filed as they expected.
Right. And I remember actually speaking about this in the office with my now former and deceased law partner, Bill Bransford, that it was the sequestration that sort of triggered people who had had a career and been there for 25. Remember that, Julie, talking about that?
That and also the lack of pay raises. People thought it's time to get out.
Well, yeah. They got their high three.
They'd had enough. You know, they'd had enough. They were like, this isn't fun anymore.
Right.
And
but you put those pieces together with what Robin's talking about. That's the crisis.
Yeah. Robin, you know, one of the things that I loved in the report that you said, and I pulled it out as a quote, that the commission's report wanted to be a blueprint for an agile and innovative government.
Right.
I liked that.
Yeah, well, that's with these varying things that we talked about, the multiplicity of issues coming up, in order to get to that, you have to take all of the recommendations as a package as opposed to working onesie-twosie. Because what we try to do is create suggestive of a comprehensive solution that could help with this idea of being agile and innovative versus not either taking it piecemeal or not at all. We think, we're facing, as we said, the crisis.
Yeah. And we interrupted you because I did, actually, and I went off on my David Walker, frolic and detour about human capital. But I think, Robin, you were about to talk to us about, because I had asked you, like, what were the challenges? You sort of first had to identify what's the crisis, and you started with human capital, speaking about human capital. But as I understand from reading your report, that what you were the vision or the identifying of the challenge was from the council's perspective, the commission's perspective. Robin, correct me if I'm wrong. It's the intersection of human capital crisis, acquisition crisis, and the technology crisis. That's that intersection of all three of these very important pieces to the government sort of workforce.
I think you nailed it. And the technology crisis isn't one of that there's a threat to technology, but rather the pace at which technology is changing, which drives out this notion of needing to be much more agile. And relooking at the construct is how human capital comes together with the acquisition processes to apply, not to be able to acquire technology, and recognizing that the technology is changing so fast. Mm-hmm. One, it's about the ability to adopt it and use it. But secondly, as we move from a paradigm of where government procured end items, they bought the licenses, they bought the hardware, they bought the buildings, put it into practice, and then operated it. You know, the new view, when you look out over the horizon, is particularly relevant to the Professional Services Council, because what we're talking about here is services acquisition.
Yeah.
Is more and more of technology is and will continue to be acquired as a service. So those traditional methods of acquiring it, and so it creates this opportunity that if you can reposition the skill set of the human capital to be more technology understood, the contracting community to understand more about technology, the CIO community to have a better capability around services acquisition, understanding how to bring that in and how to buy it as a service, then we'll be able to more rapidly adopt and apply the technology in a much more agile fashion to create some of the positive outcomes and sustain the innovation that we've seen in the past.
You know, Deb, I think also just to add to what Robin said, one of the things that we discovered in some of our meetings that surprised some of us, although the more we've socialized it, people said, oh, yeah, that's absolutely the case. We just didn't see it. We talk about collaboration between government and industry being a challenge. We know that that's a huge issue. Collaboration within government, we are told, coming from both the CIO and acquisition communities, that the collaboration between their communities is decreasing, not increasing.
Yeah, what's that about?
There's a lot of dynamics behind it, but we have such a siloed structure, and one of the things we talk to in here is how do you actually unify it more, create incentives, collaborative processes, and so forth, because that's as much of an issue as the customer talking to the supplier.
Yeah, and of course, we're not the first to discover, Robin, the pipeline issues. The 9/11 Commission, as we all remember, they were the ones who sort of put the name on what's been observed in the government, you know, over decades and decades of how it does business. The U.S. government, you know, has really become became compartmentalized. It became segmented. It became territorial. And let's all say it's just massive. And so to me, it was very interesting, Robin, to see that that was identified. You know, the idea of being pipeline and compartmentalized, and one isn't talking to the other, and because you know you used to only hear about that in the national security world, right? And what you're all talking about is that's really about how the government does most of its business, because you know, as the two of you point out, you know, the intersection of human capital and acquisition and technology, most of the government's business is done that way today. Robin, I was hoping that you could stay on during the commercial break and rejoin us so that we can go a little bit into some of the recommendations in the commission report.
Certainly.
So if you just hang on there for about 90 seconds, we'll return to speak more with Robin Lineberger, who was one of the co-chairs of the PSC Leadership Commission report, which you can find on PSC's website. But we need to take our mid-show break. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
GEICO's famous for saving people money on car insurance. And now, if you're a federal employee, you could be saving even more. In fact, you may already qualify for a special federal discount from GEICO. If you're a federal employee, or if you belong to an association like BIG, FEW, FLIOA, Young Government Leaders, and many others, you could be saving hundreds of dollars. Contact GEICO today to get a quote and be sure to request your special federal savings. GEICO got its start back in 1936, specifically to serve federal employees. Today, we're still making it easy for federal employees to save money on car insurance. If you're a federal employee, you may qualify for a special federal employee discount. Or if you belong to an association like BIG, FEW, Young Government Leaders, and many others, you may also qualify. See how much you could be saving. Contact GEICO today to get a quote and be sure to request your special federal savings.
I'm Deborah Roth, host of Fed Talk and partner at the law firm of Shaw, Bransford & Roth. Our firm specializes in helping federal employees with legal issues concerning their jobs or benefits. For two decades, we have been representing federal employees in adverse action cases, employment discrimination complaints, inspector general and internal affairs investigations, security clearance issues, and other federal employment disputes. If you have a legal concern, don't wait. Call Shaw, Bransford & Roth at 202-463-8400 or visit our website at shawbransford.com. Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth. I'm hosting this morning's show with my law partner, Julie Perkins. And today's topic is government. It's the government contractor workforce represented by the Professional Services Council. And we have their CEO with us today, Stan Soloway, in the studio. And we've been talking for the last 15 minutes with Robin Lineberger, who's a member of the council, but also was the co-chair of the PSC's Leadership Commission. And Robin, you're still with us, right?
I am.
Thank you for rejoining us. So there's a whole host of recommendations that the commission report lists, and I was hoping that you could give us sort of a big picture of what those recommendations were and then maybe focus on a couple of them.
Super. I will do that. So obviously we talked in the earlier segment about the press with human capital. And so while the government's done a pretty good job in the numbers of the increasing the numbers of the acquisition workforce mm-hmm. and putting them through some standardized training, when you look at the services acquisition core and the curriculum and the ability to keep the curriculum up as fast as the technology is changing and the methods to acquire technology and services, that's where we see a deficit. And so a broad set of recommendations that really have a couple of key points. One is to get a more blended career path or workforce between the strict contracting or services acquisition and the technology community, and not cross-training as well as working more collaboratively. Mm-hmm. And then secondly is bringing in a set of skill sets and training and skill sets beyond just acquisition rules, but more around business acumen and business understanding so that they can stand in the shoes of industry to understand how industry can better be utilized, what the pricing models would be, and then how to evaluate the value add in the alternative type proposals that you would see in the acquisition area. So again, human capital development, not only in scale but in how they're trained and how their career pathed, as we see services changing and the way that that services can be more effectively acquired. So that's one. The next key theme is one around collaboration. Collaboration between the departments within government, because as you said earlier, as we've evolved, it's become very risk averse.
Yeah.
The lack of risk absorption by the management, which sort of puts them in their corner, and hence it's driven a lack of collaboration within government. And then certainly the step back that we've seen between industry and government, that widening gap and not interacting early enough in the acquisition cycle and across the life cycle of the acquisitions, working more collaboratively with our constituents in government from the time requirements are done all the way through lookbacks after the acquisition is done, kind of looking like at a 360-degree view of how did this go, what can we do better, or how can we innovate and take better advantage? So throughout the life cycle of the acquisition, being more collaborative. And then Vier made some specific recommendations in the area of how we can provide some tools or techniques to the government for bettering acquire service. And one of them is the recommendation of using a services acquisition taxonomy. Currently, there's a taxonomy that's really a post-award accounting method of how they spent the dollars. We're suggesting that they look at the types of services that can and will be purchased and what are the appropriate acquisition methods and parts of industry should be used for those acquisitions. So if you think real briefly, looking left to right from those services that are highly structured, require less innovation and more routine, to those services on the other end of the continuum that would be highly innovative, perhaps developing something one of a kind that need a high degree of innovation and high expertise, if you will, we have to differentiate the mechanisms by which they acquire so that you can evaluate the added value, the innovation on the far right hand, while really working at comparing commodity type activity on the left. And then the second dimension to that is where in this whole of government should the work be done? Should it stay in government? If it comes out and is not done in government, then should it be done by small business, mid-tier business, large business? Should it be done by an NGO, a not-for-profit, for-profit, FFRDC? Where should that service be acquired so that the market can pivot around it and we can place the right capabilities at the right place in the market to respond to government? And then they can make better choices at how to engage and acquire us for more agile and effective outcomes in services acquisition.
Debbie, if I could just add something, I think this last point Robin's on around the taxonomy is one that it's harder to get your head around unless you have a little bit more acquisition background and so forth. And people have said, well, how does that differ from the federal acquisition regulation, which supposedly lays this out? And what I would say is what the commission tried to do is take a continuum, create a business strategy thinking taxonomy that you can then fold the rules of the FAR under. The FAR itself is not a strategic document.
It's a set of rules. That's very innovative. It's a set of rules for fair and open competition. Right. But I would absolutely agree it lacks any kind of business acumen or business strategy.
So this whole idea is to make it a more strategic thought.
That is really interesting.
And I think the other point Robin made, and Robin's much more polite than I am. I'll be a little bit more blunt.
Robin.
Robin's a much nicer guy. I think what many of us, and I won't say everybody in the commission because I don't want to get anybody else in trouble. I'll take the heat for this.
Go for it.
There are fundamental that the acquisition training system in government is fundamentally broken. That is when I look at as somebody who did acquisition policy, had the workforce responsibilities at DOD, when I look at a survey that the government leadership and frontline people are coming to us and saying, our training's inadequate, nothing's changed, nothing's better, it's getting worse. The definition of insanity is to continue to pour more money into the same system. So what we're really suggesting in the report, not worth getting into the details here, is really rethinking how we approach the whole development of an acquisition and technology community.
Mm-hmm. That's really, really innovative, interesting ideas that particularly, Stan, what you were driving home right there. And I wonder, Robin, your thought about what's the first step? I don't even know what the last step is, but how do you envision the first few steps?
Yeah, and in fact, you know, and I'll dovetail that with the last set of recommendations or observations.
Okay, thank you.
Industry has to play a role in this. We think one of the first steps is for industry to step up in a couple of areas, and one of them is to work with the government to more fully develop this taxonomy and to help them fold the rules up underneath it and tighten up that document as something they can incorporate not only today in how they execute, but in their curriculum going forward. So we think, you know, we'll make the first move. We'll provide that and start pressing ahead with that. There are a couple of other recommendations we think, and certainly industry can get started on that, as we've all seen, one of the challenges is we continually see post-award protests, even now pre-award protests, but it's convening an expert panel in the industry really to talk about this phenomenon where every procurement gets protested. And if every you're in this cycle of risk aversion on the part of the government, because everything they do, if everyone gets protested, then you can see this sort of flat cycle that we're in. How do we unwind that? So we're committed to doing that as a council. And then they're creating.
Good luck with that, Robin.
Yeah, well, we'll
I mean, this is a town driven. Driven by, it wasn't that way 20 years ago. My sense of it was that there were bid protests, but it was, I don't want to say rare, but it wasn't by no means was it in every acquisition.
I think you have to be a little bit careful with that, in all honesty. What we saw, and I think one of the things, there's no consensus either in government or industry whether you should or shouldn't have protests. I mean, this is going to be a serious conversation.
Well, I think you should.
And I think Robin's point is that there are maybe things that we can identify to improve and add discipline to the process. But one of the things that is very clear, and it's already in the report, and to your point, Deb, about the past, in the 90s, protests were ubiquitous. We just had fewer fewer procurements. But there were plenty of protests. When the rules changed in the late 90s, requiring extensive debriefings, protest numbers dropped. If you talk to any company today, they'll tell you, for the most part, debriefings really are not very effective. They're either electronic or they don't happen. And what you find is a substantial percentage of protests, I'm not going to say it's half or 20%, but some percentage, are really people trying to find out what happened. And so one of the recommendations in the report is require not a debriefing, absolutely require it, and require that it include all information you'd otherwise get in discovery. You could take out a certain percentage of protests just by doing that. Doesn't solve the problem.
And then the company could decide whether or not it's worth spending
at least
money
you have information.
Right.
And then there are other things. I think there are serious conversations to be had. And the commission had some fascinating conversations around, because there are differences of opinion. But I don't think it's that the old days were so good. There's more procurements. Plus, the last thing I'll say, because I want Robin to finish up on the recommendations, I want to cut him off, is when we went to task order buying as opposed to one-off contracts, the number of actions just skyrocketed, of course, because we're no longer buying one big thing, we're buying it in pieces. So in the professional services business, about 70% of the work now is awarded at the task order level, and under the new laws, you can now protest a task order over a $10 million value. So if that's the case, that just opens up a whole nother door. So I think there's changes to the marketplace that affect the numbers. Mm-hmm. In fact, if you looked at every government procurement, the percentage that are actually protested is very small. The problem is in key areas, like in professional services, the number is fairly high.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There are several other specific recommendations that industry should step into that you can see in the report. Mm-hmm. But they're basically where they're ready to support in some of the areas that we recommended. And I should have been more clear. You said, what's the first step? Turns out we're actually executing the first step. We've been up on the Hill as well as in the Pentagon and in the old executive offices, briefing the senior government officials. They've been very open with their calendars. Mm-hmm. They can listen to what industry has to say. So we've been out, if you will, pitching the results so that we can get engagement. As you might imagine, that with the shutdown that has distracted, that's probably a bad way to say it, they're otherwise occupied.
Right.
But
we've
certainly got positive feedback that we'll be looking, once we settle through this next quarter, is to go back and see how we can work with the government officials to drive this into action.
Yeah, one of the things that I keep mentally remarking on to myself is the use of the word innovative and agile to describe the monster, the huge, huge thing called the U.S. government. It's so, it is a big part. It is a big thing with many moving parts. And part of why things are sort of slow and not innovative and not agile is because the power of the U.S. government is awesomely powerful, particularly at DOD. And so slowness and lack of agility does make it more deliberate to sort of get to. I've always had that in my mind, that counterbalance of the power of the U.S. government is awesome, and it has to be used. And I think people in public service really feel that, that it should be very deliberate. And I think sometimes, Robin, that that is more of what slows down the making of decisions and the executing of decisions than anything else. And yet, when you, because we've all of us today on the show have been in the workforce for over 20 years. And when you think about what it was like to go to work 20 years ago, things moved kind of slowly. We didn't even have voicemail back then.
But I think this is one of the
points. And the government is like on the other side of the counterweight is the rest of the world's, you know, societies. Because of technology, everything moves fast.
Right. So there's two things. One is, and one of the points that's made in the report is, and Robin said this, the pace of technology change is at odds with the pace of government change. And so how you institute a change management process in the largest institution in the world is very challenging. But all of that said, what gives us hope, and the reason the title of the report is From Crisis to Opportunity,
yeah,
is because there are amazing things happening in the government. There are people who are with the right leadership, who have the right skills. I remember at one of the Service to America Medals dinners a couple of years ago, one of the winners getting up and say, this is exactly what can happen when you put the best of the private sector with the together with the best of the public sector with the right kind of leadership.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, Robin, I really want to thank you for spending quite a bit of time with us this morning to go over the commission's report. And I suspect that we'll be circling back with you, if that's okay, in the next few months, hopefully, to, you know, after we get past, you know, this crisis and the next fiscal crisis that that we know is on the horizon, and watch that what PSC is able to do to sort of move some of these recommendations forward. I think it'd be interesting to hear back from you.
Well, thank you, and I'd be happy to.
Okay, thanks. That was Robin Leinberger, who is a principal at Deloitte. He also serves as the co-chair of the Professional Services Council Leadership Commission, and he was the co-chair of the report, which you can read on PSC's website. It's really, really interesting, mm-hmm. and there's a lot there for a lot of us who are interested in good government and good policy to think about. We're going to take the final break of our show. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Today, my journey to help save people money on car insurance brought me to our nation's capital. I was taking a stroll around a mall when I met a very nice gentleman from Ohio who asked me a question. What kind of word is GEICO anyway? An excellent question, I replied. I told him that GEICO isn't a word, it's an acronym, and it stands for Government Employees Insurance Company. I explained how GEICO actually got its start 75 years ago to help federal employees save money on car insurance. Interesting, the man replied. But today, GEICO saves lots of people money on car insurance, including me. Have you ever thought about changing the name? I said. It's a thought. But Gecko sounds like GEICO. If we change the name, I might be out of a job. We strolled a bit more, stopped for some tea, and we both agreed. It's probably best to keep the name just like it is. GEICO.
To get a free rate quote, go to GEICO.com, then buy online or over the phone. If you're a federal employee or belong to an association like Big, Few, Young Government Leaders, and others, you may qualify for a special discount. Contact GEICO today to request your special federal savings.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth. I'm co-hosting the show this morning with Julie Perkins, my law partner. And we've spent most of the show this morning, and we're going to finish up the rest of the show, speaking with Stan Soloway, who is the president and CEO of the Professional Services Council, PSC. You know, everything's an acronym if you're inside the Beltway. And so he's known as PSC, and It is an organization that represents the interests of most of the federal government's contractor community, and we're here talking with Stan about the contractor community's sort of perspective on what's been happening inside the government. And of course, I don't know any way around this. You can't have a show today inside the Beltway and talk about anything unless you somehow pull in the shutdown, which is just, you know, been you know, had been whacking at us for weeks, mm-hmm. the scary, and then they finally pulled the trigger, I guess, 4 days ago. They talk about, Stan, I said this to you before we went on the air, everybody talks about the 800,000 federal workers who were furloughed, and it is really just very difficult to think about, you know, how much anxiety they all must have about how long this will last and how they will pay their own bills. But it's actually got tentacles, the shutdown. And Stan, you're going to tell us about some of them.
Yeah, well, you know, as we said, we live in a world of a whole of government, and there's no way to have this kind of an event and not have massive effects. I think, you know, clearly the impact on the civil service of this, the pay freezes, furloughs from the summer and so forth have been enormous.
Yeah.
There's there's no excuse for it. I think actually it's in the commission report. There's a line that says that we run the risk of the government fully devaluing people, whether mm-hmm. they're in the government or on the outside. There's a whole lot of dynamics. And so our public sector colleagues are getting beat up. You talked about bureaucrat bashing or contractor bashing. We sort of have both going on at the same time now, which isn't very healthy.
Yeah, well, so, that's by the politicians.
Right.
It's by the political arm of our government.
So, but clearly there's the ripple down effect. So we've had many companies have had stop work orders issued. Even in cases that would be contrary to the guidance that OMB put out, where they said if you have a funded contract and you're not working in a government facility, you don't need day-to-day supervision from the government, continue working. Many of those cases, the agencies said, no, you're shutting down too. And it's a difficult issue. It's a parity issue. On the other hand, you know, the government spent something like $8 billion less last year on professional services than the year before. So that $8 billion directly translates into thousands of jobs that were lost. We understand that. We're not saying they shouldn't have taken that cut. We don't believe in spending money just because it creates the job. We believe in spending it right.
Right, right.
But to suggest there's been no impact is unfair. But,
right.
you know, there's this tension out there. So I had one company yesterday had 38 stop work orders. We had a small company tell me last night at the Service to American Metals dinner that they have six of their 10 contracts have been stop worked. Mm. And so there are furloughs, and many companies, what they're doing on the short range is putting people on personal time off or regular scheduled training. They've moved the training schedule up, say, with in-house sort of overhead activities. That can't last very long for anybody if you have no revenue. And so there's all these ripple effects. I'll just quickly tick off a couple that people aren't thinking about. And I don't mean politically. I just mean in general.
Yeah.
Number one, if you're a company that build, and this one of our CEOs pointed this out to me yesterday, they build in August. They haven't yet been paid for their August invoices. September billings haven't yet gone in, and they would be going in now. But
right.
So they're going in, but they're not going anywhere because there's nobody to do the validation. Mm-hmm. And now the Defense Finance and Accounting Service has said that because there's nobody there to validate invoices, you can expect payments to pretty much shut down the next week.
Mm-hmm.
So they're looking at 90 days, 60 to 90 days of revenue being bollocked up.
Right, not just 3 weeks.
Not just 3 weeks. I
didn't really appreciate that.
If you think about it from that perspective, one of our CEOs was in one of the press the other day, and he said, look, if this thing were to last, I may get the numbers a little bit wrong, but basically, if this thing lasts 4 weeks, that's 8% of the year. That's 8% of revenue if they're completely shut down. He's operating at profit margins of 4% and 5% annually. His entire year has shot. So there's that effect. We saw in the news yesterday one of the helicopter plants is being shut. One of the large companies announced a plant closure. It's not because there's no funding. It's because the Defense Contract Management Agency quality assurance people have been furloughed, and they're not on site. You can't operate with them on site.
Right. You can't operate with them
auditing. The E-Verify system, which is, as you know, out there to validate the citizenship and so forth for new hires. You may have funded work. You need to replace somebody who leaves or an opening comes up. You can't get into E-Verify to do the validation you need to for a hire. I mean, there's all these pieces to this puzzle that are subterranean that are hitting everybody. Mm-hmm. So there are huge ripple effects. And as I said, a lot of companies really did everything they could, hoping this would be a 1 week. But even if you're a large company, but certainly if you're a small company, you go a week or a few, you simply cannot afford to keep paying your people. So people are going on furlough, they're going on leave without pay, and so forth. So there are a lot of effects. I think everybody shares a huge frustration. Obviously, we don't want to get into a debate about who's right, who's wrong. That's not relevant to this.
Right.
But the impacts on everybody supporting the government, our public sector colleagues, private sector, nonprofits, have been enormous.
Yeah.
But don't you think this is on top of the short-term CRs you've been dealing with?
Sure. So, and that's also dramatically affected the public side.
Right.
Clearly, I mean, what we found, and we can see it in the data as we've looked at the FY13 data, you can see that it's really the clarity of spending as opposed to the pure dollar amount that enables agencies to at least move forward with some degree of efficiency. And when they can't be efficient because they don't know how long they're going to have the money or when they're going to get their money, and we're not just talking the global amounts, the program level battles for resources are huge, then they can't execute, which means we can't execute. So everybody's in this boat together. That's why I said at the beginning, the divisiveness that we see out there is sometimes so frustrating because this really is a single community. And I think that there was a hearing on the Hill this summer that I testified at with the president of one of the unions. And the joke sort of at the end of the hearing was that we were literally joined, that literally put our arms around each other. We are great friends, but we don't agree on a lot of things. But the chairman of the committee.
But you agree on that, right?
Well,
agree on a budget.
Budget. It was on budget chaos. And, yeah. You know, we were all in this together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and that sort of brings me to, you know, something that I did want to talk with you about was, you know, if you go on the PSC's website and you look at, you know, why would somebody join? Why would a company join? And they've listed their 2013 policy priorities. Policy priority number one is to provide a stable budget cycle, and I guess anybody listening to this show would understand why you'd want that. But you know, to simplify it, you know, can you think of an American household where it's not based upon somebody worrying about creating stability in their own finances,
mm-hmm.
money in, money out?
Or any marketplace that can survive any degree of, you know, what markets look for. And I know the government's not a business. I'm not suggesting it should act like one all the time. But there are dynamics created by uncertainty that affect innovation. They affect efficiency.
Right.
We have a government today that is so totally focused, not by fault of the people in government, on the next quarter or even the next month. Yet a really well-run organization is thinking a year, 2, 5 years down the road in terms of investment strategies, people strategies.
Right.
So
I've been saying it at this radio station, both on our show and other shows that I'm, asked to be a guest on. I've been saying it because, you know, what are we on our fourth year without a budget? No world-class corporation. First of all, nothing in size compares to the U.S. government. You know, the size of the U.S. government, both in numbers, dollar numbers, and in, you know, the reach of it. There isn't a single company worldwide anywhere that would run this way. It would.
It's not an institution worldwide.
It makes no financial sense. And to use, you know, political issues as a wedge in running an effective government, and all of the lives it affects, you know, you think about, we only have two more minutes left to the show, but you know, Mike Causey's column here at Federal News Radio, you know, he talked about some of the effects on the contractor community, and it was he's quoting somebody who predicts small businesses are expected to be hit hardest. You know, how many small businesses can go, you know, X number of weeks or months without revenue? I mean, and then what happens when they shut down?
Yeah.
And then they're gone. Then when they go bankrupt, they're gone.
They're gone.
And then what? When they decide to refund the government, then what? Then we're in slow start.
Well, so you have the clearly small businesses, and there's been a number of them featured in various stories are under the pressure, always are, because they don't have the resources. But even mid-sized to somewhat larger companies, some of them have bank covenants coming due.
Right.
If you miss a bank covenant, that's a very big deal in a privately held company. You have publicly held companies that Wall Street's looking at, and they're not going to hit their quarterly numbers or their annual numbers, and all of a sudden they're devalued, and they're, you know. So there's all kinds of implications here. I remember one company, not for reasons of budget, a few years ago, took a big hit, and their stock dropped about 3% overnight, and it took them 18 months to make up that 3%.
Oh, wow.
Which is exactly my point. You know, once you hit them, how long does it take for these companies in the private sector economy to restart? It is really fool's folly here to have this shutdown last any longer than it needs to. Stan Soloway, thank you so much for being with us this morning. And I hope, again, that you'll keep us posted on the Leadership Commission report's effectiveness. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.